I would have had to work very hard. As far as winning goes, look, I know when you're a candidate, you're supposed to get all macho and say, ah, no, I could win. Perhaps you won't be surprised that I don't feel the need to be quite so macho, maybe as some others. But here's the point. I've run for office 20 times. I've won 20 elections, 4 to the State House, 16 here. I counted up, anticipating your question, in 5 of those cases, I entered uncertain about the outcome. In a couple of the cases, I was the underdog. In 1980, when I had moved from Boston, I won 2 very narrow races. It was a terrible year for a Democrat to run, 1980. In 1982, a large number of people thought I couldn't possibly win. I was one of them. In 1990, I entered with a lot of people saying I couldn't win. Last year, I had a number of people writing my political obituary. So the answer is, I think I would have won. But I do know this, and this is what's most relevant. It would have been a tough campaign. One, people are skeptical of incumbents everywhere. In some ways, if you are an incumbent who's representing people you haven't represented before, you get the worst of both worlds. You are tagged as an incumbent, but you haven't had a chance to show those people what your incumbency can mean in terms of being their advocate. So there was that. There was also this. Look, I don't like raising money. I had to raise several $1 million last year, and I have been raising it this year. I have probably close to $600,000 in the bank. I'll continue to have in this new district, or whoever runs, will continue to have 2 media markets because you'll still have enough of the southeastern, the Providence market. I would have to start now raising another couple of $1 million. And as I said, I think I'd win, but what's relevant to me is I could not put the requisite effort into that. And by the way, it's exacerbated. I would think part of my strength, I believe, has been that I've been very effective as an advocate for local, regional, personal needs. But once I acknowledge that it's only going to be for 2 years, that gets undercut. And people have said, don't tell them. No, I can't not say that. So then what I do know is that running a full-fledged campaign in a district, by the way, the new district, the new part of the district, is about 75% of the size of the district I was first elected. It's pretty sizable. That's the factor. Yes, Janet. No, I will not. Let me be very clear. I will neither be a lobbyist nor a historian. I promise you on both. There is no way I would be a lobbyist. I will miss this job, and I'll have some twinges of regret when the new Congress is signed up. But I will tell you this, and, you know, maybe you're going to laugh, but one of the advantages to me of not running for office is I don't even have to pretend to try to be nice to people I don't like. Now, some of you may not think I've been good at it, but I've been trying. And the notion of being a lobbyist and having to go and try to be nice to people I don't like, it would be ridiculous. No, I will not in any way be a lobbyist. I do not intend to practice law, although I have a law degree. Well, I might show up pro bono someday for a gay rights case. My intention would be to do some combination of writing, teaching, and lecturing. I am not looking for any institutional affiliation. Again, one of the advantages, I made this decision about a week ago, I was up in Maine with Jim and talking about it, and one of the great advantages is when the phone rings now, I don't tense up and say, oh, God, who's caused me a problem now? Who's screwed up and I got to deal with it? I do not plan to be responsible for anybody's actions other than my own and Jim's. Yes. I did not think I had lived a good enough life to be rewarded by Newt Gingrich being the Republican nominee. It still is unlikely, but I have hopes. Let me say, for example, I intend to continue to be an advocate of public policy. I look forward to debating, to take one important example, the Defense of Marriage Act with Mr. Gingrich. I think he is an ideal opponent for us when we talk about just who it is threatening the sanctity of marriage. I think, but what it clearly is a repudiation of Mitt Romney. It is extraordinary the extent to which Mitt Romney, and I've been struck again by people talking about the degree of flip-flopping, of changing, the lack of a core has been very well. In fact, I've been surprised by that because it's been my experience that when people say they don't like you if you flip-flop, they usually don't mind if you flip to them. If you notice, most criticisms are people who flip away. But in Mommy's case, it has been so constant. And I think there was a real question about the core of the man. So it is striking that so many Republicans seem opposed to him. And given the nature of the Republican primary electorate, which is a very conservative electorate, the primary electorate, I think it is possible that it wins. He would be, as a matter of fact, he obviously thinks so, too, because his comment about immigration is clearly looking to the final election. So, but I have to say this. He would be the best thing that happened to the Democratic Party since Barry Goldwater. Yeah. Well, I get into my biggest regret and my biggest... I can't think of my biggest. I know... Maybe, people often ask you, what's your biggest this or your first that? None of us think that way. We have several things. I will say, I will acknowledge one error that's very relevant, and that is I voted against President Bush, the first request to go into Iraq. And I did that because I was afraid he was going to do what his son did, which is to mess it up badly. I now believe that the very limited engagement in Iraq that had the sole purpose of expelling Saddam Hussein from Kuwait and not pursuing him into Iraq, that worked well. And I would have, if we were back again, I would have voted for that. I voted at one point for legislation that passed, I think, with only one or two dissenting votes, to put more restrictions on the Internal Revenue Service than I now think were appropriate. I think we suffer more from ineffective tax enforcement than from oppressive enforcement.
How about the financial
crisis? Well, what about the... No, I don't have any regrets. Here's the story on the financial crisis. I was in the minority in the House from 1995 till 2006. I, along with many others, did not see the crisis coming. And until 2003, I thought Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were doing well. I had virtually no impact on that because Tom DeLay was running the House of Representatives at that point. I did become, in 2004, concerned about subprime loans being given out promiscuously. And in 2004, when George Bush ordered Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to increase the percentage of loans they bought from people below the median income, pushing it above 50%, I said, and was quoted in Bloomberg, that that was a mistake. Not good for the recipients of the loans, not good for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. In 2005, Mike Oxley, who was the Republican chairman of the committee, I was by then the senior Democrat, put through a bill to reform Fannie and Freddie. It passed the House. I voted for it in committee. I voted against it on the floor because of an unrelated provision attacking affordable housing. But the key point is that the bill passed the House. I was in the minority, so my vote had no real impact. It then was defeated in the Senate because the Republican Senate disagreed with the Republican House. Mr. Oxley said that George Bush had given him the one-finger salute, the raciest quotation ever in the Financial Times. So the bill died. That was at the end of 2006. At that point in 2005, I did try to get legislation passed to stop loans going to people who couldn't afford them, subprime loans to people who were of too low income. That was blocked by Tom DeLay. He sent orders to Mike Oxley, we're not going to do that. That brings us to 2006. In 2006, you can read this in Hank Paulson's book, The Secretary of the Treasury, under Bush. He approached me because it looked like we might win the Congress back. And he said, he asked me if I would work with him on serious reform of Fannie and Freddie, going beyond what had happened in 2005. By that time, I was worried enough, and I said, yes, I would. And so, as he says in the book, we won, I kept my word, and I first became chairman with any serious responsibility in this area in 2007. I assume people understand that when Tom DeLay ran the House, the minority did not have much to say. So from until 2007, I had virtually no impact. In 2007, I became chairman, and one of the first things we did was to pass legislation to further regulate Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, giving the Secretary of the Treasury the powers he wanted. Not all of them, but a better bill. There was a group called FM Watch that was there to monitor Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and rein them in. They announced that they were dissolving as a result of our bill passing. Later that year, in 2007, we passed a bill to block subprime loans. The Wall Street Journal attacked us, said it was a Sarbanes-Oxley for housing, that we didn't believe in the free market, and that subprime loans were very good things to helping poor people win. That didn't pass in the Senate. The Senate did pass the Fannie Freddie regulation that we wanted. Hank Paulson then took over the regulation, and when it turned out it was too late, he put them into conservatorship. So, and he says in his book, he begins his book by saying that he was going to put them into conservatorship, and he was afraid that he would get attacked by Fannie and Freddie. The first thing he did was to call me, and I said, good, that's what you should do. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac since 2008 have been in conservatorship run by the federal government. The conservator, or the administrator of the agency that runs them, Mr. DeMarco, who's no great friend of the Democrats, because Obama keeps trying to fire him and the Senate protects him, testified when I asked him that since Paulson used the powers that were in the bill that I initiated and put them in a conservatorship, there have been no losses. The losses that you read about are payments for things that happened before that. And since 2008, they have done a pretty good job in housing and have not caused any losses. So, yes, I was late in recognizing the problem, but it was when I was in the minority. And I have the first impact I had on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac legislation came in 2007. Now, by the way, that's a telling enough point so that when I recently mentioned it on television, Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee, said, oh, no, Frank forgot that the Democrats took over the House in 1996 and held it till 2002. That is delusional. He has since acknowledged that he was wrong. So with regard to the financial crisis, oh, and by the way, when the Senate wouldn't do a subprime bill, we did incorporate that into the bill that is now law, the financial reform bill. So the kind of subprime loans that made problems for people are now illegal. Yes, two issues. Well, as I said in my statement, there were two issues that I wanted to focus on, and ironically, they're the ones that made me decide to run again, because I thought if I was a lame duck, I wouldn't have as much impact. One is defending financial reform. For example, incredibly to me, the Republicans have held down funding for the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to the same amount in the current next fiscal year as it has this year. They got the major increment of new powers because they are now regulating derivatives, swaps.